It is a great pleasure to welcome to the program once again a distinguished intellectual. Dr. Akbar Ahmed is professor of Islamic studies at American University. He is a native of Pakistan who's lived long in the West, in the UK, and in this country. He was, for a year or two, the Pakistan ambassador to the United Kingdom. They call you High Commissioner because Pakistan, that's what they do for Commonwealth countries, and Pakistan is still a member of the British Commonwealth.
Yes, yes, and very proud to be so, Milt. We still have good, strong connections with the UK.
The book you've just done, which is fascinating reading, is titled Journey into Islam. Why did you need to journey into Islam? You are an Islamist. You've been teaching Islamic studies for many, many years. You're an anthropologist. You know Islam already. Why did you need to journey into it yet once again?
I had to, Milt. First of all, let me say what a pleasure it is to be back.
It's a great pleasure to have you.
See you looking in great form, younger than ever before. I don't know what you drink here in Chicago. There must be some magic in the water, but you're looking very young and healthy. Well, Milt, it was a challenge. I had to get back to the Muslim world. I hadn't been back since 9/11. And I wanted to go back, and not just a tourist returning. I wanted to go to the Middle East, to South Asia, to Far East Asia. I wanted to talk to the presidents, to the princes, but also to the sheikhs and the students, to visit mosques and madrasas, and to take along some young Americans with me who would help me conduct questionnaires, talk to people, conduct interviews, so that when we got back, we were able to put together what probably is an unprecedented composite picture of what is happening in the Muslim world.
It makes for fascinating reading. I've been wallowing in the book and enjoying it tremendously, but also reacting with some emotion. And I must give you an honest, immediate reaction. You find hope in your interviews. My reaction was, yes, there's some fascinating detail. Particularly, I appreciated your admiration, and I share your admiration for the Sufi mystics and the universalists that you encountered at the Ajmer Shrine in India. But I had another reaction as well. I was once again appalled by the heavy evidence from your data, as you reported, the evidence that jihadism of the kill the Americans, kill the Jews, kill the Kafirs variety is still the virtual default position for many, many young Muslims.
You're right, Milt. We found in our questionnaires that a lot of the Muslims, something like 20 to 25%, which is a very high percentage, and throughout the Muslim world, remember this is the first account of actual questionnaires conducted on the ground and conducted by a whole team. And remember that Brookings, Pew, and American University were supporting the project, so it has a scientific
base. I didn't mention in introducing you before that you are also a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Yes, and then they've been very, very supportive for this project. So we found that a large percentage of youth were fascinated by these figures who they thought stood up to the West. And the louder these figures spoke, the more strident the voice.
First and foremost, Osama bin Laden.
Osama bin Laden. And we were surprised because as we went further east, away from the Middle East, we thought the myth, the mystique of Osama would dwindle. On the contrary, by the time we got to Indonesia, which is the largest Muslim nation in the world, and traditionally a moderate pacifist kind of society prevails there, we found that on campus, for example, a large percentage of Indonesian youth looked up to Osama bin Laden as the role model. Because we were really asking in each society, who is your role model?
It's not just the youth. It's also some of the leaders. One remembers the former president of Malaysia, who gave a speech in a great international Muslim Congress in which he said the Jews run the world and they are the enemy and we must wage eternal battle against them.
Yes, and Milt, there's a lot of ignorance. I would, for example, in these large gatherings I was received in mosques and madrasas and so on, campuses, university campuses, I would talk about the need to understand Jews and Christians by Muslims. And I would challenge them. I would say, what do you know about the Jewish community? In the Middle East, for example, and they'd say, well, this community is ruling the world. And we saw this in this film called The Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And I would say, do you know that that's a fiction created by the Tsar secret police in the late 19th century? You're being informed or misinformed through a fiction. So it is a challenge, Milt. It's a major challenge in the media, in the Muslim world.
But strange things happen. That film and it was done as a television series, I believe, was done in Egypt. And Hosni Mubarak, the president of Egypt, obviously signed off on it, even though Egypt and Israel are in diplomatic concert.
Exactly. So on
so
the
it's
one
the leaders,
hand,
it's the leaders as well as
it is. It
the
is,
kids.
And that's what I'm trying to point out. That in my book, I try to create three distinct models of Muslim leadership. Mm-hmm. The first is the mystic, universalist, humanist model. Rumi, for example, that's the classic quintessential figure, the great poet, very popular in the United States. The second is the modernist model, the person who wants to live in his own tradition with integrity and yet reach out to the West and create bridges, absorbing the best of
your hero, Jinnah.
My
was
hero,
just
Milt. God bless you for mentioning Mr. Jinnah here in Chicago.
He's the founder of Pakistan.
Founder of Pakistan, an extraordinary figure, believed in human rights, women's rights, the constitution, man of great vision, and really wanted a moderate Muslim nation for Pakistan. And you see where Pakistan has got to. It's very tragic. And
it's
then
got itself in some terrible trouble.
And probably worse to come now. And the third model, so we have two so far, and the third model is quite distinct, which is the literalist orthodox model. Now, the literalist model believes, Milt, since the mid-19th century, that Islam is under attack. And Islam needs to be defended by creating boundaries, withdrawing the moat, as it were, and simply rejecting the outside world. So I'm simplifying, I must underline this, simplifying the three models. But if you understand it in terms of these three models, then you're right. The third model is on the ascendant. And you take a look at the Muslim world, Somalia, Hamas in the Middle East, Hezbollah, right across the Muslim, and in Pakistan now, in Afghanistan, the evidence is that this third model is now ascending. And therefore, there is cause for alarm within the Muslim world. Muslim leaders, you just pointed out, Hosni Mubarak, Muslim leaders have to take their responsibility much more seriously.
Let me offer you another Muslim leader. So far, I think all the Muslims we've talked about are Sunni. Here's a great Shia leader. You can anticipate whom I'm going to quote, the president, the current president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who says in a famous speech delivered in 2005, there is no doubt that the new wave of attacks in Palestine will wipe off this stigma, Israel, from the face of the Islamic world. Anybody who recognizes Israel will burn in the fire of the Islamic nation's fury. While any Islamic leader who recognizes the Zionist regime means he is acknowledging the surrender and defeat of the Islamic world. As the Imam Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini said, Israel must be wiped off the map.
Now, Mil, this is very unfortunate.
That's pretty strong stuff.
Very, very strong and very unfortunate for the head of state to be making statements like this. And as a Muslim,
just before he calls a conference on Holocaust denial.
He denied the Holocaust, and I found that quite unacceptable as a Muslim. And I'll tell you what we did in Washington. I, with a group of my friends, with the Imam of the largest Islamic center in Washington, in the Washington area, Imam Magid, an extraordinary fellow who the Time magazine called the American Imam, we led a delegation of Muslim leaders to the Holocaust Museum, and we were received very warmly by Sarah Bloomfield. This is in December, at the same time that this conference was being held in Iran. So once again, there are these strands and trends in the Muslim world, and we, and this is really, I'm speaking as a Muslim, it's the onus is on us, the Muslim intellectuals, the writers, the scholars, the leaders, and so on, to engage and move the debate in the Muslim world in a certain direction.
A great question of historical interpretation is, where does this kind of revival of jihadism, a revival of this exclusiveness, this regression to what anthropologists call a nativist redefinition of the faith and redefinition of the culture, where does it come from? What prompted it? And I know you've got interesting and full analysis in response to that, which I want to hear. We all want to hear it right after we pause to do a little brief obeisance in the direction of capitalism. And my very special guest for the evening is Akbar Ahmed, who is the author of the just published book, Journey into Islam, The Crisis of Globalization, that is published by Brookings Institution Press. He is, that is, Dr. Ahmed is, the Ibn Khaldun Chair of Islamic Studies at American University, former High Commissioner of Pakistan to the United Kingdom. Explain the naming of your chair. There are some listeners who don't know who Ibn Khaldun was.
Ibn Khaldun was one of the greatest, in fact, probably the father of the subject or discipline of sociology and anthropology. He literally single-handedly jump-started this discipline. And what is amazing is he comes from nowhere. He's born in this dusty little town in what is now Tunisia in North Africa, creates this enormous corpus of work, dies, and leaves no school behind. And yet, Milt, throughout the world, in the West and the East and North and South, he has an immense impact. He was the first to talk in terms of science, the rise and fall of dynasties, for causal factors, not just because of the will of God. So in that sense, he really introduces something that had not been introduced before in the social sciences.
That, undoubtedly, Ibn Khaldun and much that he represents and all of that tradition of rationalism in the context of Islamic faith, all of that is disdained, obviously, by the guys up in Waziristan.
Waziristan, but again, remember, go back to my models. It is not disdained by the modernists. Remember the modern renaissance within Islam, and that's overlooked and forgotten today. But for the last century or two, especially from South Asia, the middle of the 19th century saw Muslims responding to Western colonization in two distinct ways. There was the modernist response, and in that modernist response, the feeling was personified by Aligarh, this university in South Asia. Mm-hmm. The feeling was that Islam can be a modern religion. You can wear a blazer, a tie, speak English, and yet be comfortable with parliamentary democracy, with Shakespeare, with the best literature from the West.
You mentioned Aligarh. That's a university, a modernizing university in India. You have three places in India that sort of represent symbolically the three main turns in contemporary Islamic life. Aligarh is one. The other is Ajmer. We've mentioned that, the Sufi shrine to a great Sufi saint, also in India, and Deoband. And it's what Deoband represents that has come upon the world and is causing so much consternation. What is the place, Deoband? What's the larger movement?
Deoband, like Aligarh, was a response to the crisis in Muslim society in the mid-19th century. Two distinct responses of the Muslims of South Asia. Aligarh was the modernist. Deoband was the very much orthodox literalist. Draw the boundaries around Islam. Islam under attack. Islam in danger. So the boys at Deoband, the students, dressed in traditional clothes, spoke Arabic or Persian, refused to speak English, never wore blazers and ties and so on, never played cricket.
And felt that all truth was to be found in the Quran.
In the Quran, and literally in the Quran. So, and I want to underline this, Milt, not everyone at Deoband by any means would advocate violence. This is very important to understand. However, the feeling among Deoband would be that if Islam is under attack, they will stand up and defend it. This is a very important sentiment in Deoband. Now, you asked, where is this turmoil coming from? You're right, it is that kind of thinking. So the further the pressure on the Muslim world, the further the strength that Deoband gets today.
But the Deoband kind of approach to the fate and to the challenge and to the aspirations of Islam is prefigured, certainly, by Abdul al-Wahhab. And Wahhabism begins, that is the tradition pushed by the Saudi Arabians, though it's making some trouble for them, after all, and it's the tradition upon which Al-Qaeda draws, and that goes back to the 18th century.
Exactly the same model. The Wahhabi model is a mirror image of the Deoband model. Similar scholars, overarching philosophy, Islam under attack, the need to reform Islam, puritanical Islam, even a literalist Islam. And again, not everyone in that tradition would want violence. At the same time, very much see themselves as warriors, champions of Islam.
Well, what accounts for the new rise, the return, and the intensification of this Wahhabist, jihadist, Salafist kind of militancy?
Here's the answer, Milt, which I tried to give in my book after this detailed and intensive journey. Number one, the gap in the Muslim world between the very rich and the very poor. Mm-hmm. Number two, the low levels of education. And remember, Muslims really value education, and they're seeing the shambles of education around them. The corruption, the nepotism, the sense of hopelessness, the corrupt rulers in the Muslim world. Remember, out of 57 states, the vast majority are corrupt military dictators. Now, this is fueling anger, dismay, and outrage in the Muslim world. So ordinary Muslims look around and say, who will represent us? And very often they reject the Sufis, they have lost patience with them. They'll reject the modernists who failed, you know, one election after the other, one corrupt democratic government after the other. And they say maybe, maybe, just maybe, these extremists or literalists or fundamentalists, whatever you like to call them, maybe they have the answers. So maybe they can solve the problems of this world. And then finally, what also fuels this anger is the Islamophobia coming from the West. So like I mentioned, the Elders of Zion, this program that's being shown on Arab television, we have channels in the West showing all kinds of nonsense against Islam, Islamophobic programs, demeaning the Prophet of Islam, the God of Islam, the religion of Islam, and that feeds into the sense of anger and outrage in the Muslim world. And then the literalists can stand up and genuinely say, I am the only figure within Islam prepared to defend the honor of Islam. So you can see this interconnectedness of our world.
The astrophysicists and the cosmologists often speak of the Big Bang as, quote, a singularity, something of which there is no model, and it, in a way, is the beginning of everything. Our era, the problem of our era, begins with a great singularity that occurred on September 11th, 2001, in New York City. There's been killing before. Al-Qaeda were bombing American barracks in Saudi Arabia. They attacked the coal, and we know about all of that. But what they did on that day stands out as incomprehensible and thus utterly figural, and it defines our time, or it defines the clash of civilizations which is now underway. How do you account for that event?
That event is a failure of the world to promote the idea of dialogue, the idea of the dialogue of civilizations as against the idea of the clash of civilizations. You're absolutely right. That terrible, tragic day is symptomatic of the clash of civilizations, where so much hatred crossed from one civilization into another, killing thousands of innocent people. And the cycle of violence has continued. Today, Milt, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and I'm afraid now Pakistan is being caught up in this turmoil. Very, very soon you will have hundreds of thousands of people who've died needlessly, needlessly. These ordinary civilians, moms, dads, and so on, nameless, but they are someone's relatives, someone's beloved.
Now, there you're talking about Muslims killing Muslims.
Not only Muslims killing Muslims, remember there are unfortunately American troops in Iraq,
Yeah,
in Afghanistan.
but
They're
in
dying, they're
Pakistan
being.
and in Iraq, Shia are killing Sunni, and Sunni are killing Shia.
Shias killing Sunni, Sunni killing Shia. In Pakistan, you're seeing both ethnic and sectarian violence. So it's becoming a kind of free fall. And go back to your question. When an ordinary Muslim looks around and sees chaos, people being killed in mosques, in madrasas, in Islamic centers, that Muslim says, who is doing this to me? It is my ruler who has failed to give me justice, law and order, and stability and security at home. And that person, that ordinary Muslim, really says, I want a more Islamic order where I will have some justice, where I will have some stability, because that is what an Islamic ruler will give me, not these corrupt people. Therefore, you see, strangely and paradoxically, Milt, this turmoil reinforces, doesn't weaken, the third model. Therefore, I point out again and again that the model that I would want to promote it, that is the Jinnah model, where Jinnah says, I am going to be the protector general of the Hindu minority in Pakistan. Just think of what I've said, Milt. This is not Gandhi speaking. This is the founder of Pakistan, who, when he saw a riot being conducted against the Hindus in Karachi after Pakistan was made, jumped into the fray to prevent the riot and said, I will constitute myself the protector general of the Hindu minority. That kind of Muslim leader is needed today, a man of integrity, a man of compassion, a man who is inclusive of people. Now, unfortunately, when you look around the Muslim world, you see leaders lacking vision, lacking wisdom, lacking common sense.
But you know, you're working a bit with the great man model of history. Such leaders are needed, but they're not there, you say. But in a way, the time produces the leaders that fit the themes of the time, or fit the degeneration of the time.
I agree, Mel. That's a very interesting observation, because I've often thought to myself, you know, I'm a Weberian sociologist, and Weber, of course, was the great sociologist of the man of charisma in terms of leadership. And I look around the world today, and you look at the leadership here in the United States. You had a generation ago, you had the Kennedys, you had Martin Luther King Jr., and so on. And today you don't have that same kind of stature. In France, you had de Gaulle. In England, you had Churchill. In Pakistan, you had Jinnah. In India, you had Gandhi and Nehru. These are really world-class leaders. These are.
And these are, by some political scientists, are called transformative leaders. The nature of their leadership is they do really transform their societies, or they solve certain problems, or they move things in a new, often a healing direction.
Healing direction, and when they leave, they've left something behind so that all people feel that they represent them. I'll tell you, I was a young undergraduate in the 60s in the United Kingdom, and I'd never visited England. I was studying at university in England. And when Kennedy died, now he was not the president of my country, he wasn't the president or prime minister of England, but when Kennedy was shot, we in England mourned as if though he was our president, because we never saw him as an American president. We saw him as a world leader. So that's the point you're making, that these leaders had some extraordinary quality. I agree this is a sort of great man view of history. But when you look around the leadership today, you really despair. You say, where are these extraordinary leaders who could say, like Gandhi, who took on the tidal wave of emotion and would say, go to a Hindu community and say, I will fast unto death unless you stop killing the Muslims. And then he's shot by a Hindu. Mm-hmm. Those are extraordinary figures.
Just as the Prime Minister of Israel was shot by an Orthodox Jew.
Oh, well, yes, yes, absolutely. These lines.
Religious fanaticism tends to kill people.
Even in Pakistan, President Musharraf has almost been assassinated several times by Pakistanis.
And we return to Akbar Ahmed, professor of Islamic studies at the American University in Washington, former ambassador for Pakistan to the United Kingdom. That meant you went to the Court of St. James and...
Court of St. James, presented my credentials to Her Majesty the Queen.
You have to kneel when you do that, don't you?
Not kneel.
But that's only when you're knighted, I guess.
Yeah, I haven't been knighted yet, I'm afraid.
I said I wanted to play some excerpts from a recent program. Stephen Schwartz was here. Very interesting fellow. The name sounds Jewish, and he had a Jewish father, a Christian mother. He was raised basically as a Christian, and converted to Islam, deeply moved, but particularly by Sufism. And he now runs, and he has the same general view you do. The Pacific aspects of Islam are there, and they must be brought forward, and the world must know about them, and they must be resold to the Muslim mass, is his feeling. As such, he helped to found, and he is the director in Washington, of the Center for Islamic Pluralism. And he writes a good deal, particularly in the Weekly Standard magazine, but yet others. So we talked about problems similar to what you and I have been discussing. Here is the first of two brief excerpts.
Traditional Islam is a pluralistic religion. It's a religion based, as Judaism is, on discussion, on argumentation, and on reaching a consensus. Wahhabism, Saudi Wahhabism, eventually backed by the oil money, got rid of that. And because they control the holy sites, because they have so much money, they are attempting to wipe out Islamic pluralism everywhere Sunnis live, and that includes trying to wipe out Sufism, trying to get rid of Shias, as we see in Iraq, trying to get rid of non-Wahhabi Sunnis, as we see in the Balkans and Indonesia.
Wahhabism is named for its founder, who first promulgated this particular variant of Islam, Ibn
Abdul Wahhab.
Abdul Wahhab, who's in the 18th century in what is now Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
What did he originally assert?
He originally asserted that he asserted something that had really not ever been claimed in Islam before, which is that the Muslims had fallen back into unbelief. And this is the common strand in Wahhabism in the view of the Muslim Brotherhood and of the jihadists in Pakistan. It's that the ordinary Islam of the man or woman living in Indonesia or Bosnia or Morocco, ordinary Islam, an ordinary religion, pretty much like every other religion, where you pray and do various things and believe various things, that isn't Islam, that's fallen back into disbelief, unbelief, and that to cure the Muslims of unbelief or disbelief, they had to do various things that Ibn Abdul Wahhab wanted them to do. And he came from a part of Arabia that frankly had no distinguished Islamic scholars in its past. A lot of people say that they hadn't really been Muslims there. But he came forward in the 18th century with this basically messianic view of himself. Non-Wahhabi Muslims say that Ibn Abdul Wahhab thought of himself as greater than the Prophet Muhammad. And he said that the existing Islam was not Islam, that it was disbelief, and that people should be killed if they didn't accept his version.
Now, that is crucial.
Yes.
Kill anyone who is not of our faith.
Well, no, of our sect.
Of our sect.
Interpretation, yes.
And does that still hold?
That's
does that, is that still the meaning of Wahhabism to this day?
That's what's going on in Iraq right now. When you know, when you hear about the foreign fighters in Iraq, they're overwhelmingly Saudis. And Iraqi Sunnis and Iraqi Shias don't call them insurgents. They call them the Wahhabis, because that's who they are. And their argument is that they claim that the Shias, by the way, they claim are Jews, which is the first time you hear that is pretty strange. That anybody who does not follow the Wahhabi doctrine is not a Muslim, has fallen back into disbelief, and if they don't accept Wahhabism, they should be killed.
Your reactions?
He's right. Milt, he's right. There's a very strong strand of mysticism and pacifism within Islam, the Sufi variety, if you like. There is also opposed to it the literalist version of Islam that we've been talking about. I come from South Asia, Milt, where we've had both varieties. What people don't often see, because in the media, Pakistan, for example, is being projected as a land of potential terrorists and so on, and there's so much violence being reported from that country. What is not reported are the deep wellsprings of Sufism in Pakistan, in South Asia, where villages, where entire regions, in fact, have this great tradition going back centuries. Do you know there have been emperors in South Asia, Muslim emperors like Akbar, who would have weekly gatherings of rabbis and bishops and Hindu priests. There have been figures like Mian Mir, the great Sufi of Lahore, who actually helped plant the foundations of the great temple of the Sikh faith. So these are extraordinary figures who are acting as bridges between. You mentioned Ajmer. Now, I took my American students with me and my American team with me to Ajmer, and you can imagine the scene, these American kids sitting with me in the courtyard of one of the most famous Sufi shrines of the world, and sitting, and I would constantly ask them, are you feeling secure? Are you feeling comfortable? Are you feeling any sense of unease? And they would say, we feel so welcome here.
Let me ask you to elaborate just a bit on Sufism. Americans by now, even though they don't know much about Islam, have learned the distinction between Shia and Sunni. But Sufi may be a term that they can't quite place. What is that variant of Islam? What are its basic precepts? What is its lifestyle?
The basic variant of Islam, I wouldn't even say variant, I would say it's very much mainstream Islam, because remember, this form of Islam is inspired by none other than the form of the Prophet himself, is simplicity. It is inclusiveness. It is reaching out to people. It really is great tolerance of other people and acceptance of other people. The quintessential Sufi, who may not be known as a Sufi but is so popular in the United States, is Rumi. Rumi is actually the number one best-selling poet in the United States of America. And again, Americans seem to love Rumi. There's a new film made by my friend Kel Kearns, just about to be released, a television film for the cinema halls, called Rumi. Rumi Returning. And again, the themes of Jewish, Muslim, Christian, overlapping, the idea of unity in faith, the idea of reaching out, the idea that we could live together in friendship, in harmony, this is all reflected in Rumi. Rumi's famous verse is, Milt, which I have in the book, I go to the synagogue, I go to the church, I go to the mosque, I see the same altar and the same spirit. That is Rumi, that is Sufism.
But I'm not sure that you can easily and fully trace the origins of Sufism to Muhammad, or that you could call him the first Sufi, because what I have in mind, and I must be straightforward about this, what I have in mind is the quotations from the Quran that you get in justification of Wahhabism and in justification of killing. I need to read something to you. Saif al-Din al-Ansari, in an article in Al-Qaeda's official periodical, presents the new comprehensive concept of total extermination of Islam's enemies based on the Quranic verse, quote, and that he may purge those who believe and deprive the unbelievers of blessings. That's from the Al-Imran 142. And going on, this is an Israeli article, to be sure, an Israeli scholar of Islam and who's been studying Wahhabism particularly. He says, Al-Ansari further developed his concept of total extermination in a subsequent article. First, he firmly criticized the Islamic movements that raise the banner of Dawah, Islamic preaching, and support the gradual spread of Islam through education, social organizations, and the economy as the preferred means to bring about the victory of Islam over other religions. He asserts that Allah has the power and might to subdue the infidels and to exterminate them by his will. However, he has not done so because of his wish to designate this task to Muslims. One more paragraph. Al-Ansari relies on the Quranic verse, quote, "Fight them. Allah will punish them by your hands and bring them to disgrace," meaning that Allah will kill the infidels, "and he will assist you against them and heal the hearts of a believing people." End of quotation. The key word in this verse is "by your hands," which indicates the great importance Allah attributes to the physical action of the infidels' extermination. This is even more substantial than the dawah in executing the command of jihad, since the dawah, as important as it might be, could not fulfill God's commandment for extermination.
Now, Milt, I've heard these arguments many times before. I'm, of course, not a religious figure. I'm not a cleric. But I do know that all religious texts, all of the Jewish faith, of the Christian faith, of the Muslim faith, all of them can be interpreted the way the individual wants to interpret.
There's a saying in the West, the devil can quote scripture to his own purpose.
Exactly, to his own purpose. Now, what I see also from the Quran, and I'm quoting the Quran, there is no compulsion in religion. I can give you quotation after quotation of the Quran where God says, "We have made you into tribes and nations and states so you may know each other, so that you may wonder at each other in acceptance, in compassion." The Prophet of Islam, we just heard about him, when he conquers Medina, Makkah, when he comes back from Medina to Makkah with an army, and Mecca falls, and these people have been persecuting the Muslims, there have been blood feuds, there have been hatred on both sides.
We're back in the 6th century.
7th century. And his own commanders say, "This is the day of revenge." Mm. And he reprimands them and says, "This is the day of compassion," and orders the army to lay down their arms and declares a general amnesty. Now, this is the Islamic revolution as great in history as the revolution in Russia, as the revolution in China. And how many died in this revolution? Maybe 3, 4, 5 people.
Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, peace be upon him.
Absolutely. The two greatest names for a good Muslim are compassion and mercy. God is compassionate and merciful. Mm-hmm. I really interpret it this way, Milt. If you ask me, I'm again not a religious cleric, but if you ask me how do you define Islam, I would say a God that defines himself as compassionate and merciful cannot be ordering people to blow themselves up and
yet
create violence.
Yet a specter haunts the West, and it's the specter of the apprehension that lots of young Muslims are ready to come up and blow themselves up and blow up the West, and they aspire to do more than they achieved even on 9/11. Let's do it with weapons of far greater devastating quality. The other great concern, I say to Dr. Akbar Ahmed as we return, is of course, what kind of damage can the Wahhabists, can the jihadists, can Al-Qaeda do in the West if they are seeking weapons of mass destruction, and may very well get them, if not from Iran, possibly even from North Korea, for all I know, or random nukes controlled by retired, somewhat drunken former Soviet generals who may in fact have some of that stuff available to sell on the international market. I said I have another clip from a conversation with Stephen Schwartz. It bears directly on these matters. Here it is. When they come to one provincial country, not a great player in the Muslim world, not a vast number of Muslims in the population, but that population is growing all the same, namely the United States of America. To what degree is Wahhabism represented, or for that matter, dominant in Islamic life in this country?
The situation is much worse in America and Britain than it is in any Muslim country, because all of the Muslim countries, including Saudi Arabia, have some form of pluralism, some form of opposition to extremism, to fundamentalism, to Wahhabism, to jihadism, whatever you want to call it. They have diversity. In almost any given Muslim city outside of Saudi and Iran, there are different mosques belonging to different interpretations and different Sufi orders and whatever. But in America and Britain, the Wahhabis and the Pakistani jihadis are in the saddle.
Do they control most of the institutions?
We believe that they control 80% of the Sunni mosques in the United States. This does not mean that 80% of Sunni Muslims in the United States are Wahhabis. But it does mean that because of the Saudi money and because of the opportunity that the appearance of real Islam, as opposed to Farrakhan, pseudo-Islam, with the appearance of real Islam as a substantial community in the United States in the 1990s, the Saudis stepped in and created a Muslim establishment.
And what about the cross-national or the national organizations? What about CAIR, for example?
Well, the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Islamic Society of North America, the Muslim Political Affairs Council, all of these groups are groups that essentially exist to, I coined the term Wahhabi lobby for them. They are groups that exist to maintain the radical Islamist control over the religious life of American Sunni Muslims.
Does that then also suggest that there's a strong push towards training young men, or for that matter young women, to undertake jihadist assault upon American institutions?
I wouldn't say that any of those organizations are directly involved in training, or even at this point necessarily raising money for jihadism. But what they have done is they have created in the mosques an atmosphere, a theological atmosphere, conducive to jihadism. Now, it would be dishonest of me to deny that the fact is that they've lessened their profile on this since 9/11. Before 9/11, it was quite outrageous. If you went to any ordinary Sunni mosque, you would hear, you know, you must do the maximum for the Muslims who are suffering around the world, and if you want to go fight in jihad, that's good.
There you have it, a rather abrupt end to that segment, but it points up the danger that we are really in such danger, or we at least have the delusion that we are. What do you think it is?
I think he's right to point to the possibility of this situation in the West, Muslims living in the West, particularly among the young. At the same time, Milt, I am also optimistic. You have some extraordinary young Muslims involved in discussion, debate, bridge building. Here in Chicago, you have this extraordinary young Muslim leader, Ibu Patel, done a lot of work in interfaith initiatives. In my own book, I give the example of two figures from the London School of Economics, 1990s. They never met, but one of them went on, Omar Sheikh, to be implicated in the murder of Danny Pearl, the son of my great friend Judea Pearl, and the other, my daughter, went on to become the first director of the first ever Jewish Muslim Center at Cambridge University. So again, you have this young generation involved in both directions. The challenge for Muslim leaders, both here in the United States and in the UK, is to somehow push the young Muslim generation more towards, I would say, the Ajmer model and the Aligarh model, where they can begin to reach out and live as citizens, useful, vibrant, vital in today's world.
Ah, the one quotation I regularly draw from the works of Vladimir Ilyich Lenin is the title of one of his pamphlets, What is to be Done? How do you get from here to there?
From here to there, I would say several steps. The first step, I think, is the understanding that it is absolutely crucial, this exercise. The exercise we're having to talk about the need to understand Islam. And let me repeat very quickly, Milt, why it's important. 1.4 billion people, 57 nations, one nuclear for the time being, and very soon, maybe within a decade, several more nuclear. And then, don't forget, 7 or 8 million Muslims living here in the United States. American troops in Afghanistan, in Iraq, Pakistan, close ally of the United States.
And Western Europe possibly becoming Muslim majority in some of its countries by the middle of this century.
Exactly. So and by the middle of the century, one out of four people on this planet will be Muslim. So really, for Americans, it's no longer a luxury, an academic exercise to understand Islam. This is imperative. Now, if we understand this, then three steps need to be done. Number one, a serious process of dialogue, both sides, with Muslims coming to synagogues, to churches, beginning a process of dialogue, both sides, we going to Christians and Jews going to mosques. Number two, reading of each other's literature, understanding the wellsprings of their civilization. Mm-hmm. And number three, forming friendships across cultures, across religions. It can be done. It has been done. My own friendship with Judea Pearl has transformed me. I have understood so much about his history, his love for Israel, the history of Israel. So many things I've learned because of this friendship.
Meanwhile, the question that persists is, what do you do about the people who are trying to kill us? Al-Qaeda is there. They have troops in the tens of thousands, I would imagine, of people who can be recruited. They have influence on a few million others, obviously. We've agreed that that is the case, particularly among the Islamic young in some parts of the world. And the danger persists. And what should Western policy be, quite apart from dialogue, quite apart from fusing the two cultures, but what should Western policy be in terms of squelching, containing, and defeating the great threat to our lives? We have not tonight, in conversation with Akbar Ahmed, drawn some of the detailed and concrete material from his wonderful new book, Journey into Islam, but there are many great encounters and much by way of human narrative, which is of considerable fascination and delight, and at the same time, there's much to worry about. Journey into Islam, The Crisis of Globalization, just published by Brookings Institution Press. I was raising the, or persisting with the question of how one really goes forward to produce this change of heart and produce this new level of, ascend to this new level of mutual understanding between cultures. I've used the phrase clash of culture a few times. You do, of course, in a way, endorse that concept as developed originally by
Huntington,
by Sam Huntington at Harvard. You agree that there is a kind of clash between East and West now.
A kind of clash taking place, but also a kind of, and a very vigorous dialogue of civilizations taking place. I would say, Milt, the first bit of strategy to implement is to avoid, I mean, I wouldn't want to be in dialogue with people who want to blow up people or kill people or harm innocent people. I just won't waste my time with them. But I would be very concerned about what you said, the hundreds of thousands, millions mm-hmm. of ordinary Muslims who are wavering between the three models. I would target them and win them over, genuinely have a campaign to win hearts and minds. Mm-hmm. I would ensure and promote democracy, human rights, civil liberties in the Muslim world.
Permit one quick interruption. There is a fourth model, which you haven't mentioned there, and yet I know you're aware of it, and that's the model of full secularization, in a way an abandonment of organized religion. That happens also.
That, by the way, is
in the Islamic world.
Yeah, that is, Milt, if you read carefully, the Aligarh model is not simply saying we will go towards the West or capitalism. There were also within that model people looking to the Soviets. For example, your models of Saddam Hussein and Assad of Syria were really the socialist model. Mm-hmm. That hasn't been particularly successful in the Muslim world. So that didn't really develop. I have mentioned that in the book.
I think of somebody like Ayaz al-Hirsi, who's been on this program also. And she clearly has given Islam up, finding it simply too oppressive and too mistaken. She's much pained by the status of women in Somalia, where she was raised, as I remember.
The status of women in Islam is really a cause of great concern to any thinking and caring Muslim. Women are very often not given their share in the property. They're very often treated in the most disgraceful, degrading manner. You have these horror stories coming out from time to time. At the same time, Milt, I'm very encouraged by the Muslim women themselves. They are fighting this mm-hmm. battle. You see across the Muslim world, Muslim women involved in changing the world, Muslim women as prime ministers, as presidents, as lawyers, as editors, as ambassadors. So it isn't an entirely hopeless situation. I'm very confident, and this change will come not through necessarily the men, who are very often ignorant and very often backward and aggressive looking in terms of their attitudes to women, but women themselves.
It was, of course, the attitude or the plan of the Bush administration when it entered Iraq, whatever you think about the WMD threat, but it was their plan to put down a great tyranny and to plant a seed of democratization, with the general understanding that democratic states don't make war against one another, and they don't attack one another, whether with formal military armies or with terrorists.
Many flawed assumptions here. For example, the idea that somehow democracy was being introduced to the Muslim world. I don't think any of them had read the history of Pakistan and the Pakistan movement, which, as I said, was led by Mr. Jinnah, and I'm talking of the 1940s.
Yes, quite recently, 1930s. So to speak. Yeah.
Yeah, so these people were already wanting to create a modern Muslim state based in democratic notions. It isn't something that has been introduced to the Muslim world. Unfortunately, it wasn't allowed to flourish for many reasons, for local reasons, for international reasons, and very often the need of Washington to prop up military dictators in the Muslim world. You remember the famous saying of the President of the United States about some South American dictator, he's a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. Mm-hmm. Now, that attitude, Milt, in the Muslim world has ensured the continuation of many dictators.
That was Roosevelt speaking of Somoza of Nicaragua.
That's right.
Yeah. Are you saying that we've done the same?
In a way, you have in the Muslim world, and ordinary Muslims, again, are very frustrated. They would want nothing more than democracy, straightforward democracy. Even if those rulers are inept and corrupt and incompetent, let them be elected in and let them be booted out. India succeeded because India, and I'm saying this as a Pakistani with perhaps some reluctance and some sense of shame, that here's our neighbor, India. Pakistan and India fought three wars, and yet India's secret has been its democracy. Whatever happens, the democracy chugs along. It may not be the most perfect democracy in the world, but it is the largest democracy in the world. And you see, India is being totally transformed as a nation, as a regional power.
Well, let's spend a moment or two on your own country, on Pakistan. You served in its diplomatic service. You had other civil posts of high significance in your earlier career. Things look rather dangerous there at the moment. What's going on?
I'm very concerned, Milt. I have been, as you know, commissioner in Balochistan. I've been the head of the administration of Waziristan, where Osama bin Laden is supposed to be hiding. What you're really seeing is an implosion on many levels in Pakistan society. You're seeing religious conflict, you're seeing sectarian conflict, and you're seeing a sort of loss of will in terms of the government. There seems to be anarchy at the district level. So ordinary Pakistanis who want stability, want law and order, are not finding it. And what they're seeing is they're being pulled between several poles. The ethnic pole, so many people in Balochistan, for example, or the frontier province are talking in ethnic terms, or then ideological poles. Many of them are now wanting a much more militant and violent form of Islam than the Islam I knew when I was growing up in Pakistan. I grew up in a Catholic school, and we looked up to the priest, we admired the priest, they were our role models. Today, churches are being attacked, Christians are being attacked. It's a very different kind of Pakistan. And again, I often think, what would Mr. Jinnah say to the country he created if he were miraculously to be reborn? He would be amazed at some of the trends in Pakistan, Swati, and he'd be very concerned because ultimately we Pakistanis are very conscious that in a sense Pakistan was an experiment in a modern Muslim state which hasn't quite worked.
Are things going to get worse in Pakistan before they get better?
I'm very pessimistic, Milt, unless the leadership of Pakistan begins to show very quickly a lot of wisdom, a lot of sense, and a lot of compassion, and I'm not seeing too much of that
right
now.
What should General Musharraf be doing?
He should be doing three things straight away. Number one, he should announce that he's taking off his uniform and end the uncertainty around that issue. Number two, he should allow all political parties to participate in elections. Right now, the leader of the PPP, the Pakistan People's Party, the leader of the Muslim League, Nawaz Sharif, these are exiled. What sort of elections are taking place with the major political parties not in action? And thirdly, he needs to do something about the high levels of anti-Americanism in Pakistan today. This is a cause of serious concern because Pakistan is a key ally of the United States of America. It is one of the pillars of the American strategy for the war on terror in the East. And without Pakistan, American strategy in Afghanistan would collapse like a house of cards.
At the same time, it provides, though not willfully, but in fact, it provides haven for Osama bin Laden.
Not only haven, I'm afraid, Milt. The bad news is that the tribal areas are now seeing a resurgence of the Taliban. And what you don't know here, because it's not reported, the Taliban elements are now spilling into the settled district for the first time in the history of Pakistan. So you have settled areas, like my wife comes from Swat, which is the royal state. She's in fact the granddaughter of the former ruler of Swat. Those were settled districts. You could not conceive of what's happening there. Right now, you have mullahs who are running amok there, just holding up cars, pulling out anyone who's not dressed in a certain way or what they consider an Islamic way. There is no law and order in certain parts of the frontier province. Bombs are exploding. We don't know who's killing who. And very soon, you may have a state of anarchy and a situation which is out of control.
And they do have nuclear weapons.
They have nuclear weapons. There's a crisis brewing with Iran over the nuclear program. Both are neighbors. I would be extremely concerned about Pakistan, because if Pakistan implodes, it'll make Iraq and what's happening there look like a picnic, because Pakistan is a country of 165 million people. It has a geopolitical situation which is unique. Take a look at the map. It's got China on one side, India in the south, the Arab world in the West and to the North Central Asia. It's an absolutely key ally in terms of strategic interest for the U.S.
Are we going to get through the next decade or two without the use of a weapon of mass destruction by Wahhabist, jihadist nativists?
I'm not sure who will be using it or when they will be using it, but I am very concerned, Milt, because right now you have a race in the Muslim world. Iran has declared its intention to go nuclear. Now, that means you've triggered off a race within the Muslim world, which means Saudi Arabia is already muttering about a nuclear program. Egypt is not far behind. Turkey is already talking about it. And the UAE will not be far behind. So very soon, within a decade, maybe you're going to have half a dozen or maybe even more Muslim countries with nuclear programs or nuclear weapons. I would be very, very scared. Let me state straight away that I don't trust anyone's finger on the nuclear button, whether it's someone from the East or the West. Don't forget, the only time the nuclear bomb has been used from people in the West, from Americans bombing Japanese, that is, countries in the East. So I just am very, very, very wary about the nuclear program. It kills hundreds of thousands of people, destroys humanity. I would very much want a world which is much more peaceful, much more tolerant, and much more compassionate.
Yes, I think we all want that. But again, Leonard's question is important. What is to be done? How do you get there?
Milt, the answer is read my book.
A very good useful aid in that quest. I absolutely agree. Journey into Islam by Akbar Ahmed is published by Brookings Institution Press. And we will go directly to the phones and to the email as we continue in conversation with Akbar Ahmed, whose visit to Chicago is coordinate with the publication of his very important new book, Journey into Islam, The Crisis of Globalization. Our phone number, 591-7200. We've now got a few lines cleared. If you've been trying to reach us, do try again. If you're moved to do so, move quickly. 591-7200, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Hello. I wanted to ask about Kashmir. This has long been a problem between India and Pakistan. I was wondering if the guest thought that there would be any kind of settlement or anything in the horizon, and how is the situation at present?
The Kashmir question is a very relevant one for South Asia. Remember that India and Pakistan have fought three wars. Both are nuclear. Both are literally eyeball to eyeball across a border in the subcontinent. And President Clinton called this the most dangerous place on the planet. So this Kashmir issue has to be resolved between these two countries. This is a large state up in the north, wonderful people with a great tradition of tolerance and acceptance. And unfortunately, hundreds of thousands have died in the most brutal manner as these two states continue to fight and confront each other over the fate of Kashmir. And in the end, the people who suffer the most are the Kashmiris themselves. So really, I would urge the leaders of India and Pakistan to resolve the issue of Kashmir as soon as possible, in whatever manner they do this, because this has been going on for over half a century, right from the creation of Pakistan in 1947.
So you don't see any resolvement in the issue?
I don't see any brilliant moves on either side. I don't see any bold initiatives on either side. You really need leaders of compassion and wisdom to break the deadlock. Right now, you have a situation where both countries just drift along. They have these meetings. There's some kind of thaw in the air, and nothing very much is resolved. The result is that while the bureaucrats meet and talk, the people of Kashmir continue to suffer. And this suffering really has to stop. We are not talking of a marginal or small amount of people. There are literally millions of Kashmiris. It's a large part of what was once the British Empire, a princely state, perhaps as big as a European country, the state of Kashmir. And unfortunately, no such solution in sight.
Yeah, it's very troubling because I'm a person of Indian descent also. I mean, I think they should come to some kind of settlement. You know, I mean, I've been to India. I've never been to Kashmir. I've heard it's like a paradise. I mean, that's what I've heard. I've never been there. That's all I've heard. Have you been there? Can you describe the place?
Well, I used to be assistant commissioner in charge of this side of bits of Kashmir, what was then called Azad Kashmir. It's a beautiful, beautiful part. You're absolutely right. In fact, there's a famous couplet of some famous Persian poet written in the 15th or 16th century, which said that if there's a paradise on earth, it is here, it is here, it is here. And they described the beauty of Kashmir. And it was famous that the great Mughal emperors would go there for the summer just to spend their time in that beautiful vale. And of course, the first Prime Minister of India was from Kashmir, Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru, and he loved Kashmir very much. The problem is, of course, everyone loves Kashmir, and therefore people are reluctant to give it up. And of course, ultimately, who suffers is the people of Kashmir.
Our thanks to the caller, and an invitation to those who are listening to join us if they have questions or comments. We'd love to hear from other members of the broad Muslim community of Chicago, or for that matter, any place else in the country or the world. 591-7200. But just as you don't have to be Jewish to enjoy Libby's rye bread, you don't have to be a Muslim to call us here on this program. 591-7200. And if you are listening over the internet at some greater distance, the email address is extension720@tribune.com. And let me read you an email that I've got in front of me. If I could ask Dr. Ahmed a question, if he were president of the United States, what are the first three things he'd do to deal with the threat of Islamic terrorism?
I would straight away declare to the Muslim world that I want to promote democracy, human rights, civil liberties, three things, and I would mean this, because that would transform the landscape in the Muslim world. That would automatically marginalize and isolate the men of violence. It would encourage those who want to be living in the modern world, in the 21st century, as citizens of the world. And it would give hope to the millions that there is some solution to their problems inside. Right now, you're finding hundreds of millions of people facing a very bleak future. So therefore, you're finding them wavering. What direction do they take? Should they become extremists, fanatics, violent people of violence? Should they just continue suffering as they're suffering now? They really are in a very frustrated situation. So the President of the United States can do so much with the vast resources and the vast investment right now in the Muslim world. Take Pakistan, for example. The United States is very generous with Pakistan. Since 9/11, Milt, as I pointed out in my book, the United States has given something like $10 or $15 billion to Pakistan. Now, a lot of that money, I would say half that money, goes to buying weapons, helicopter gunships, tanks, and so on. Unfortunately, a lot of that weaponry is used against the people of Pakistan, so Baloch tribes or frontier tribes. And therefore, the people of Pakistan resent American aid in the form of weapons, which is used to kill them. How much gratitude do you see? Very little gratitude. Suppose that 50% was spent straight, clause in the aid. This goes for education, translation of books, teachers' training programs. This will translate the great works of Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin for Pakistanis, and in turn translate the sayings of Jinnah and the great poet Iqbal for Americans here. You will suddenly see a shift in perception of these two civilizations to each other.
A personal question occurs to me. You have been a high official of the Pakistani government in your time, ending as the Pakistani ambassador to the UK. Before that, an administrator of sectors of the country itself. I know that on your last trip, you had a conference with Musharraf. There's a picture of you and Musharraf, and I think your two American students sitting there chatting and dining. What did you say to Musharraf, and how does he respond?
He was very receptive, very hospitable. He kept referring to me as Akbar Sahib, which was a term of respect. And my American students were very impressed. They said, we've never seen a president who'd be so deferential almost to their professor. He was extremely forthcoming, very open about the questions I asked him. I asked him some very hard questions on the state of Pakistan, on the state of the madrasas, for example, on the state of his own thinking about the issues in Pakistan. I asked him who his role model was. And this was very interesting, because I asked him which books had inspired him. And of course, he began to rummage in his mind. And the answer was so unexpected, because his hero was Napoleon Bonaparte. And I could imagine that a military man would be fascinated by Napoleon. But to him, I think Napoleon's significance was that Napoleon was a military man who used his access to power to reform society. Now, where I think Musharraf has failed is that he may have had that vision, but he hasn't been able to implement it. So after 7 or 8 years of Musharraf's rule, you still have major problems within Pakistan and major problems around Pakistan. So Pakistan has problems with its neighbors like Afghanistan and really needs to be very, very quickly coming to terms with its problems before things spin out of control.
And we go back to the phones. 591-7200 is the number. Some space is available on the board. If you've been trying to reach us, make another quick try at 591-7200 or for email, extension 720 at tribune.com. And you are next on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. My name is Patrick Frook. I come to you listening to this conversation as what I would say is just an individual, a private citizen, wondering what it is that, you know, I could do to contribute to this spreading of compassion, the dialogue, creating the dialogue between seemingly disparate cultures in order to, I don't know, bypass some of the posturing that are done by the political figures in our countries, and forge the gap between, both geographically and culturally, and really just fostering a dialogue of compassion. And it strikes me as we have this wonderful invention, this tool, the internet, that has done so much to join people from different places in the world, to a recognized affinity and common appreciation for things. Is it possible to do the same between, common everyday Americans like myself and those many millions of Muslims that are on the fence deciding how to consider us? Is there anything like that happening? Go ahead and I'll give you the single idea I had regarding that in Iraq. But go, please, I want to hear if there is any initiative like that.
Well, first of all, thank you for asking that question. I think it's such an important emotion in the question that you've asked. Yes, a great deal can be done. For example, some of the discussion about Islam in the United States, particularly in the media, is so hostile. It is, frankly speaking, so Islamophobic that, and remember, it's being seen throughout the Muslim world, that does not help anyone talking of bridge building. You know, it really becomes a problem. Now, on the other hand, you have someone like, let me give you a live example from my own book. In the Middle East, one of the role models that was written down by Muslim women was none other than Oprah Winfrey here in Chicago. And okay. I was very amused. I said, why does Oprah, how does she, because she's not even a Muslim. And they said that Oprah Winfrey, after 9/11, which was a very bad and difficult time for a lot of ordinary Muslims, because they were suddenly, it was believed that every Muslim then somehow or the other was one way or the other associated with what happened on 9/11. Oprah Winfrey had a program, her first program on Islam, Islam 101, and reached out, made an attempt to explain Islam. So suddenly someone from America was making a big impact. So I would say, yes, you can do a great deal. You can reach out. In turn, you can invite Muslims to your home, to your church, if you're Jewish, to a synagogue, and begin the process in reverse. Go and visit a mosque. And that you'll see immediately starts a dialogue, friendships start to form, and attitudes begin to change. Now, suppose this was done on scale by thousands and thousands of Americans, overnight you will change the perception. And I'm afraid that challenge has to be taken, because if we don't, then the very high levels of anti-Americanism and anti-Semitism in the Muslim world, which I report, which my team and I encountered, that will continue to rise in terms of the temperature. And we really need to bring that temperature down.
Sir, we thank you for the call. Let me pick up on what you've just said. One aspect of what you've just said, when you mentioned Israel, we have not talked about Israel tonight particularly, but of course there is there's a vast wave of a reservoir of anti-Semitism flowing constantly, breaking the boundaries, breaking the walls constantly, and you encounter that every place in association with the general militant position. As a Jew, I'm with relatives there, that is in Israel. I'm very concerned as to what the prospects are for that nation to survive. It's not New Jersey, though it's the size of New Jersey. It's Israel, surrounded on three sides by essentially hostile states, though it's made peace, to be sure, with Egypt and with Jordan. But it's a cold peace with those states, I would think. And threats of nuclear weaponry to be developed in Iran and Lord knows where else. Pakistan already has it. Pakistan falls to the Wahhabists. God knows what they will do with it. Is it your sense that Israel can survive?
This is a very important question, Milt, and I, of course, have so many friends from Israel. The head of the anti-Semitism section in the Foreign Office, a great friend of mine, she came to Washington, specially asked to see me, was brought across by a friend and colleague at the Israeli embassy to my home, and we spent some time. And this is the advice I gave her. I said, look, all your efforts to win hearts and minds are directed outside the Middle East, but you're not living outside the Middle East. You're living in the heart of the Muslim world. What attempts are you making in the Muslim world to win hearts and minds? Therefore, my premise is this. Israel is stuck in the Muslim world. There's no way out of it physically. It is surrounded by hundreds of millions of hostile Muslims, largely hostile, some very, very hostile, some indifferent. Let's not just blanketly create an opinion or a monolith of the Muslim world. At the same time, remember the demographics of the Middle East. In 50 years' time from now, end of the century, you're going to get Israel's population, 5, 6, 7 million, whatever it is, maybe a little bit more, maybe another 2, 3 million. But the Arab world, the Muslim world, is going to be right now you have something like 300 million Arabs, you're going to have something like 600 million Arabs. And at that time, you may have a dozen nuclear states. And with this kind of wild anti-Semitism, which is flowing like a typhoon, like a cyclone in the Middle East, I am really very nervous. I would want the energies of the Israeli, the Jewish populations to really reach out to the Muslim world and tackle the hatred there. And it can be done.
How do you do it?
I'll tell you how it can be done. Milt, I give you the example of Judea Pearl, a man whose son is brutally, savagely killed in Karachi by Muslims. This man has become a symbol. You know the dialogues he
and I
have.
This is the father of
Danny Pearl. And Judea and I have been, for the last many years, straight after Danny's death, we've been traveling all over the world in these Jewish-Muslim dialogues that feature him and me. And he has, by this action, transcended this terrible personal tragedy, given an example to the world of reaching out to that very civilization that took his son's life. And do you know, I see this, Milt. I see he gets letters from Pakistan. He gets letters of support, of admiration. Now, if this can be done by one man who did not set out to win hearts and minds in the Muslim world, to the contrary, he had every reason to be annoyed and angry at the Muslim world. Why can't it be done by more people? Now, I know there are enough people on the Muslim side to reciprocate. That has to be done to isolate the extremists who talk about wiping out entire populations in the Middle East, who talk about nuking people, who talk about denying the Holocaust. If that doesn't happen, well, then you have every right. You say that you're Jewish, you have a great sympathy for the Israeli people, and you have relatives there. I would be very concerned, because how long is this situation going to last? Israel really is an island surrounded by a sea, and that sea is foaming right now. It is seething, and that has to be calmed.
We share the same apprehension, but I differ from you in that you have a reservoir of optimism that you draw upon. Maybe it's a virtue of my aging process, but I grow more and more pessimistic about the radical imperfection of human nature and the radical imperfectibility of political states. I think a kind of Gresham's law applies. Bad motives drive out good. Unintelligence drives out intelligence. Amorality drives out morality. And I fear that's true at the levels of states and social movements, as well as an individual, more so than an individual life, in fact.
Milt, that's a very good observation. The difference is I am very much more Abrahamic than you are. To me, my faith drives my optimism. Ultimately, I believe in the goodness of the divine being. God is compassionate and merciful, and that trumps everything. I know I have great reservations about human character. You know, I mean, remember, I'm the generation 1947 when, as a boy of four, I saw chaos around me, anarchy around me in India,
the partition of India
to Pakistan. almost 2 million people were butchered in the most savage manner possible. 15 million people were displaced. Now, I grew from that generation, and yet I maintained the optimism because I believed ultimately in the goodness of humanity.
That is the difference between us. I'm Abrahamic in origin as well, and I'm a loyal Jew, but I'm not a Judaic Jew. I go to the synagogue once a year, and I honor it, but I do not have deep faith, deep religious faith.
You must come to Washington and meet my great friend, Senior Rabbi Bruce Lustig, and you'll become much more optimistic, I promise you, Milt.
Right now, I will indulge a lesser faith in our advertisers, and we'll pause for a last round of those messages, and then right back to the phones and to the email. And directly back to Dr. Professor Akbar Ahmed, the holder of the Ibn Khaldun Chair of Islamic Studies at American University in Washington, former High Commissioner of Pakistan to the United Kingdom, and the author of a number of books, the most recent, an utterly readable and really quite gripping new volume, Journey into Islam, The Crisis of Globalization. I want to read you an email, very interesting one that I've got in front of me. On any given day, visitors from around the globe can be found at Vatican City, the spiritual home of more than 1 billion Roman Catholics. But it isn't only Catholics who come to St. Peter's Basilica. All people are welcome, and millions of people come each year. By visiting the Vatican, non-Catholics gain a greater appreciation and understanding of Christianity in general, and of Catholicism in particular. That was certainly the case when world leaders gathered at the Vatican for Pope John Paul II's funeral service 2 years ago. My question to your distinguished guest is this: when will non-Muslims be welcomed in Mecca? And why aren't churches, synagogues, and temples, not to mention Bibles, allowed in so many Islamic countries? Tolerance is a two-way street, but Islam seems to line that street with one-way signs.
Milt, I'm afraid I don't agree at all about this one-way sign. Maybe in Muslim history, it's this tolerance going from the Muslim world in the other direction. I'll give you so many examples. In fact, in this book, there's so many examples. I myself grew up, as I said, in a Catholic school in North Pakistan, in the heart of the Islamic Republic of Pakistan. My wife went to a Catholic school, and these are really the elite schools of Pakistan, very popular. One of my class fellows became the president of Pakistan, was chairman of the Senate, Wasim Sajjad. The present ambassador to Washington from Pakistan is another class fellow. So I don't agree that there's been intolerance from the Muslim world. Yes, we are going through a bad patch right now in terms of history, but the great churches in Karachi, in the center of town, in the town I grew up in, Abbottabad, they're still there, they're intact. We grew up with great respect for the Christian priests who taught us. If there's intolerance, it is because Muslim society itself is going through a crisis. We've been discussing this. So I won't take this tone that, well, Muslims are not tolerant people, because on the contrary, if Muslims were that intolerant, then 10% of the Egyptian population would still not be Christian after over 1,000 years of Muslim rule.
To be sure. It varies country by country. The listener emailer probably has in mind, particularly, is Saudi Arabia.
Yes, Mecca itself, of course, he's right. No non-Muslims are allowed to Mecca.
And nor is any church allowed to be established.
No, not allowed in the country. And that, again, we need to put it in context. Mecca, the Saudis and Saudi Arabia is an extremely important Muslim country for Muslims. Remember the great cities of Mecca and Medina, the holiest place in Islam in that country. But we must keep the context in mind, which is it is one of the 57 nations. There are nations like Morocco with a great tradition of hospitality and acceptance of other faiths. You know the famous example that when Hitler's Nazis asked the then ruler of Morocco, who became the king of Morocco after the Second World War, he said, put these yellow markers on every Jew that you have in Morocco. He said, send me so many millions of yellow markers because every one of my Moroccans will wear this one, a badge of honor with the Jews. So you've had that kind of response also from the Muslim world. So I would be very wary about just simply dismissing an entire civilization. As, for example, you have this labeling in the West, Islamo-fascism or jihadism, or these words which just don't only signify a small violent section of society, but label an entire civilization. I think it's even a travesty, because when I'm talking about Rumi and mysticism or the moderates, and they're also to be labeled as Islamofascists, it does create a lot of anger in the Muslim world, and unfortunately pushes the wavering mass more towards the extremist position.
But why aren't there more more Akbar Ahmeds? You speak strongly, clearly, and with in a gentlemanly manner, but at the same time, you condemn the turn towards jihadism, quite properly and correctly. There are not too many men of your distinction and of your position in Islam who do the same.
Milt, there are many, many more people, much better than me, more distinguished than me. Maybe you haven't come across them. It's not been easy also. Remember that Muslim scholars in the Muslim world have had a very, very rough time
in the last couple of decades.
I mean, I myself, when I first began my dialogue with the Jewish people here in the United States after 9/11, there was actually a headline in a Pakistani paper, a major Pakistani paper, headline saying, Akbar Ahmed, sole Muslim voice in wanting dialogue with the Jews. Now, this was inflammatory. Remember, this is just after 9/11, when there's still a great deal of Taliban sympathy in Pakistan, particularly in certain of the services. The idea was to convey that Akbar Ahmed is somehow sold out. Now, in the 1990s, when I became the first Muslim ever to go to the great synagogue in London, I was asked to give the annual lecture, the Goldstein Memorial Lecture in London at the St. John's Synagogue. Again, some Muslims, especially the radicals, the Muhajirin, the Hizb, they attacked me. It became a debate within Islam. I also took some very distinguished Muslims with me.
Have you felt yourself in physical danger?
Well, I've had many threats. I've had very nasty threats coming to me, sometimes very physical threats. But again,
that's part of the answer to my question, isn't it? That many are intimidated by the danger they would expose themselves to.
Well, Milt, again, if you recall my earlier answer to you, that I do have deep, deep, deep faith. And I believe that when the time comes, I'll be ready to go up and meet my maker. And whichever way he decides to send me up or down, I'm prepared to accept that fate. But I'm not prepared to be cowed down, and certainly not by those people who claim to speak on behalf of my faith, on behalf of my tradition, my history, and really ruin it not only for themselves, but for everyone on this planet.
Of course, there are within contemporary Islam some cross-national reform movements, are there not? Some intellectuals, that is academically based intellectuals, seem to have organized and attempted to write a new plan for the modernization of Islamic states.
Yes, there's a great, as I said, ferment in the Muslim world. I mean, I was very encouraged on this trip through the Muslim world. I didn't see a dormant Muslim civilization. I saw great vitality. There's great debate between the models. Of course, at times it can take a very sharp, aggressive tone. It can be even violent at times, but it is a live civilization. That gives me hope. And that's why I conclude this book at the end, if you recall, in the epilogue, where the senior rabbi Bruce Lustig, my friend, and Bishop John Chain, my friend, the three of us have this great dialogue in the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. So that's a culmination of this great dialogue and friendship that we were expressing through this particular meeting. And we've continued to have this momentum build up. Now, that reflects the vitality in the Muslim world. Muslims are prepared to reach out across the ethnicity, across religions, across culture. And again, we need to be conscious in the West, which way do we push the Muslim world? Which way do we nudge it? Abusing the Muslim world, abusing God, abusing the Prophet of Islam, is not really going to make us many friends. It's going to lose friends, lose influence. So again, if the intention is to create bridges, to create friends, we need to have a strategy and go for it. I've showed this in my book. It is possible. We have shown it by examples in the book. It can be done. And we really need to understand the urgency of why it needs to be done.
We have only a minute left. You've been a teacher at the at American University in Washington. What sort of response do you get from your own students? Indeed, what happened to the two American students you took along with you?
Well, they really say that it was a life-changing experience, and they are my star students. They've been incredible. They've really picked up so much from that trip, and in turn become great ambassadors for America and its dialogue and understanding with the with the Muslim world. My students are very inspiring, Milt, I must say this. And remember, I'm out of a class of, say, 25, 30 of ceiling. I get something like 50, 60 applying every year. Extremely enthusiastic, optimistic, and they give me great hope for the future.
And if I were an optimistic fellow, I would say you give me great hope for the future. You certainly don't depress me.
Thank you, Maj. Thank
you. It's rather an exciting vision that you put before us. Akbar Ahmed is the author of the newest book on his long list, his long bibliography, which is titled Journey into Islam, The Crisis of Globalization. And that is just published by Brookings Institution Press.